Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this evening's program of the Commonwealth Club of California and the Contra Costa Times, brought to you from the Dean Lesher Regional Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek, California. I am Joe Epstein, past president of the Commonwealth Club, and your chair this evening. We also welcome the viewers of C-SPAN as well as a nationwide radio audience joining us for America's longest-running radio program. And we invite all of our listeners and viewers to visit the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. The recent plea bargain of alleged spy Wenho Lee has brought much unwanted attention to the Los Alamos National Laboratory and to its director, today's Commonwealth Club speaker, Dr. John Brown. And not since Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were tried and executed in 1953 for passing atomic secrets to the Russians has a spy case drawn so much attention. Claims of racism were espoused in 1953, just as they have been since the discovery that Dr. Lee downloaded secure computer codes of nuclear warheads to a non-secure, pocket-sized backup tape. Attorney General Janet Reno and FBI Director Louis Freeh defended their handling of the Wenho Lee case and made it very clear, and I quote Mr. Freeh, "Dr. Lee was not investigated because he is an American of Asian descent. He was not indicted because he is an American of Asian descent. And he was not incarcerated because he is an American of Asian descent." Freeh reminded the press that in early September, Dr. Lee pled guilty to one of 59 felony counts. After a steady increase in the hiring of Asian Americans over the past 8 years at Los Alamos, there has been little or no applications from this ethnic group since the firing and arrest of Wenho Lee. It may have been an understatement when Dr. John Brown commiserated to his staff in a recent open letter that this has been the most difficult period in the history of Los Alamos. As the director of the Los Alamos Lab, Dr. John C. Brown oversees a facility that occupies 2,200 buildings and encompasses 43 square miles. Extraordinary research is conducted at the laboratory, mostly known as the birthplace of the atomic bomb under the Manhattan Project. Los Alamos is also widely known as a preeminent center of research in nuclear physics, as well as research and development of supercomputing. Currently, the lab is building the world's most powerful computer, capable of performing 30 trillion operations per second. 30 trillion operations per second. Dr. John Brown became the director of Los Alamos National Laboratory in November of 1997, having been at the lab since 1979. He has held several positions there, including physics division leader, associate laboratory director for computational and information sciences, associate director for defense research, and associate laboratory director for experimental physics. From 1993 to 1997, he was program director for Los Alamos Neutron Science Center and for energy research programs. Dr. Brown is a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and he was elected as a fellow in the American Physical Society in 1987 and is a past recipient of a National Aeronautics and Space Administration fellowship. He is a member of Phi Kappa Phi, Sigma Chi, and Sigma Pi Sigma Honor Societies. Please give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to the director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, Dr. John C. Brown.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here this evening to address the Commonwealth Club. And given the competition with the presidential debates, the turnout actually is quite impressive. I thought that I might be speaking to two or three people, including my son, who's in the audience. I wanted to talk about the subject of science and security, and the title I chose was Achieving the Right Balance. And the reason is not just because I think it's important to Los Alamos National Laboratory or even Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, but because I think it's important to our country and our society as a whole as we move into this next century. What I'm going to try to do is give you a little bit of history of our laboratory and how we have approached our mission both a long time ago and how we approach it today, the similarities and some of the differences, and see if we can draw some distinctions and impressions about what we should do as a nation with respect to those two topics, science and security. Los Alamos National Laboratory was, which I know you all know, is located in northern New Mexico, about 35 miles from Santa Fe, was created in 1943. At that time, its main purpose was the Manhattan Project. In a short 27 months, the people at Los Alamos were able to create the first atomic bomb. That was an incredible feat for a fledgling laboratory, to bring together disparate people from all over the world to come together and solve one of the most difficult and challenging technical problems. What is not as well known is that the University of California has managed Los Alamos National Laboratory since its beginning in 1943. It is our belief that the University of California fosters an environment conducive to the spirit of scientific inquiry, the discovery of new knowledge, and the intellectual freedom that allows us to participate fully in the world scientific community. However, we also recognize, because of the type of mission we have, that our scientific research must be tempered by security considerations. Security and its relationship to science has always been part of the organizational culture of our laboratory. As a matter of fact, the Manhattan Project was the first really large government project in which scientific contributions were absolutely essential to the success of the project. And that methodology has underpinned national security ever since. Prior to the formation of the Manhattan Project, a lot of the research backing up the development of nuclear power and nuclear weapons was going on at universities around the country, Columbia, Chicago, etc. You all know the story there. But it was bringing that group of people together into a multidisciplinary laboratory where the physicists, the chemists, the engineers, the mathematicians could rub shoulders and could work on a problem together, a complex problem that allowed them to make such rapid progress. Los Alamos, then the site of a residential ranch school for boys, was chosen for its remote location and rugged terrain because it made it easy for security to be enforced in such a remote area. General Leslie Groves, a very forceful and direct military commander, was chosen to head the project with J. Robert Oppenheimer, who most of you realize came from here in the Bay Area, from the University of California, Berkeley, was a brilliant theoretical physicist and became our first scientific director. I think these two men embodied the science-security dichotomy. When Groves started to bring people to Los Alamos, he wanted to induct all of the scientists into the military and have them wear uniforms. Interestingly, Oppenheimer went along with that. It was only when they found out that they couldn't recruit people that they dropped that condition. At the same time, Groves, who believed in compartmenting information and isolating people from each other so that security secrets could be kept, objected to the regular weekly colloquium that was held at Los Alamos, where all the scientists and engineers got together to discuss their findings and their issues. It was the morale of the Los Alamos staff that was so intense and so negative about Groves trying to control their weekly get-together that he finally gave in and allowed the colloquium to go forward with this mix of people from the laboratory. Interestingly, we still hold this colloquium at the exact same time, 8:10 a.m. at Los Alamos, as it was held during the Manhattan Project. It's a tradition. It's one that dies very hard. Today, the laboratory employs over 10,000 people. We have an annual budget of about $1.5 billion. We still are located on 43 square miles in northern New Mexico, but we are no longer isolated, either geographically or electronically. 50% of our workforce works off the hill, as we like to say in New Mexico, with 20% living in Santa Fe alone. Our workforce is now very diverse, with 51% of the workforce being women and minorities. We have 350 postdoctoral fellows at our laboratory every year, and 1,300 students visit us annually. Typically, we will have several thousand visiting scientists from foreign nations at our laboratory. Our primary mission is still the conduct of scientific research and technology development to enhance national security. The largest part of that mission is stockpile stewardship, ensuring the safety and reliability of the nation's nuclear weapons without nuclear testing. But we also provide new technologies to deal with the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, including chemical and biological weapons. We support efforts to clean up the environmental legacy of the Cold War and develop solutions to other national security problems in energy, environment, critical infrastructure, and health. The point I want to make is these mission elements are very closely related. I think it's less well known that Los Alamos scientists use the skills that they develop for their national security missions to push back frontiers in fields other than national security, serving society around the globe. And this is why I feel so strongly about this balance between science and security. If we cannot have the cross-fertilization of ideas, we will not get the gains as a nation that we need to have to solve some of the most complex problems that exist. Science is a nonlinear process. It doesn't work by compartmentalization. One can still protect secrets, but one cannot prevent the advancement of science in a way that will prevent people from furthering their own knowledge and therefore letting the country gain from that benefit. As Mr. Epstein said, in the past couple of years, the laboratory has been rocked by a series of unrelated and unfortunate incidents. In 1999, a former Los Alamos weapons researcher, Wenho Li, was indicted by a grand jury on 59 counts for improper handling of classified material. Specifically, he transferred classified information from a secure computing environment to an insecure computing environment, and then he downloaded it onto portable media. We found out during his plea bargain that what we thought were 10 tapes that he created of this information was actually 20 tapes, that he made duplicate copies of the 10 that he originally had made. In May of 2000, the laboratory and the town of Los Alamos were devastated by a wildland fire that was started as a result of a controlled burn by the Park Service. That fire burned almost 50,000 acres, including 8,000 acres on the laboratory site, about a third of the laboratory. It destroyed 460 residences in Los Alamos town site and caused our laboratory to suspend operations for the better part of a month. And for those of you that have experience with the Oakland Hills fire, which in many ways was a much worse fire, from the number of homes that were destroyed, I think you understand the impact that has on a community. Right after the fire, on June 1st, two computer hard drives containing classified weapons information associated with our Nuclear Emergency Search Team, or NEST team, was determined to be missing from a classified vault, only to reappear several weeks later behind a copying machine inside the security area. This downloading incident by Wenho Li prompted invitations for me to testify before almost a dozen congressional committees who wanted to understand how they could help fix the problem. I know one question that's probably in your mind. which I see written in the press quite often. Was the downloading incident really serious? My answer to that question is yes, for many reasons I think it was serious. One is because of the information that was downloaded and we don't know where it went. Another reason is it pointed out some serious vulnerabilities, I think, to us about how information was handled after the end of the Cold War, including some changes in classification by the federal government. However, let me answer by also quoting Attorney General Janet Reno's testimony last week to a joint hearing in the Senate. And here I quote, "It is critical to understand that Dr. Lee's conduct was not inadvertent, it was not careless, and it was not innocent. Over a period of years, Dr. Lee used an elaborate scheme to move the equivalent of 400,000 pages of extremely sensitive nuclear weapons files from a secure part of the Los Alamos computer system to an unclassified, unsecured part of the system, which could be accessed from outside Los Alamos, indeed, from anywhere in the world." In response to this case, Congress subsequently passed legislation. They mandated polygraph testing for our employees. Our travel budgets were reduced by a third. Funding for our basic exploratory research was cut by a third, approximately $27 million at Los Alamos. And a moratorium was placed on visits by sensitive foreign nationals to our laboratory, even though there never was any connection established between the visits of foreign nationals and any of these incidents. All of these measures, coupled with the devastation of the fire, have caused morale problems at the laboratory, making recruitment and retention of top-level science and engineering staff very difficult. Employee morale was also affected by the Department of Energy's decision to re-examine the University of California contract to manage the laboratory. We now appear to be moving closer to a solution to that issue, and we are working closely with our friends at Lawrence Berkeley Lab and Lawrence Livermore Lab and the University of California officials to develop a response to the Department of Energy that I think will address many of their concerns. I know there's been a lot of controversy regarding the treatment of Dr. Wenho Lee by the Department of Justice. Did racial profiling occur in the original DOE-FBI investigation of possible espionage? I'm not really sure, but I think this issue is so important that it demands an independent review of the actions of both the Department of Energy and the FBI. I know it affected our Asian Pacific Islander community. It has had a dramatic impact on them. I've spent a lot of time discussing the issues with them, and I think they feel that they were singled out, not just because of Wenho Lee's actions, but because of all of the negative publicity that occurred in the national media regarding this incident. However, even given this fact, we cannot ignore the fact that Dr. Lee did plead guilty to one felony charge. Now, what about his harsh treatment in jail? Our opinion is that the Department of Justice chose how to deal with Dr. Lee in jail, and from our perspective as a laboratory, it was very difficult to influence the Department of Justice during that period, although I had discussions with the Secretary of Energy, Secretary Richardson, and he had several discussions trying to see if there were ways to deal with that incarceration. Nonetheless, that was the responsibility of the Department of Justice. What we hope will happen now that Dr. Lee is out of jail, that the discussions that he is required to have with the Department of Justice and the FBI will provide a definitive answer to the question of what happened to the downloaded material. Was it destroyed? Where did it go? Does it still exist? I think that's the main question that we at the laboratory would like to hear the answer to. Although there is still more to be learned about security incidents, these two in particular, I believe we understand them well enough to develop practices and procedures that would inhibit their reoccurrence. And we actually have taken many measures to do so. But the country needs to learn from this incident as well. I think the Congress, the Department of Energy, and the media need to think about the reaction that they had to this particular set of incidents. Reaching closure on these highly controversial issues will help us restore morale at the laboratory, but it's not going to come quickly. It will allow us to refocus our attention on the important scientific and programmatic work we do in support of our nation's security, but it's not going to come quickly. Let me talk a little bit about this issue of science and security. There were a lot of articles written and a lot of statements made by very powerful people in this country that said we shouldn't have our scientists working with people in the open. They shouldn't be working with foreign scientists. They shouldn't be working with people in the university community. Well, there's always been a tension between science and security. That's not new. It's not new in today's world. It was not new 50 years ago. Science always flourishes in an open environment, an exchange of ideas through debate and cross-fertilization. Security has totally opposite goals. It wants to keep information away from people. It wants to compartmentalize, and it wants to have a need to know. The real challenge is how can we in a free society get those two objectives and manage them? You'll never make them compatible, but you can manage that tension. We've done it at our laboratory for 57 years. I think we can demonstrate that we can do it again. Some people talk about information. How can information be classified if the scientific laws that are involved in weapons design are all open scientific laws? And what I mean by that is that if you take Newton's laws of motion or Maxwell's equations or Schrodinger's equation, of course they're unclassified. What makes something classified is how you put it together with a set of information that allows you to solve a problem that makes something classified. And also, what you are using it for, the purpose of the research that you're doing. Just like words in a dictionary are unclassified, when you put them together into a paper, you can make a document that is very sensitive and very classified, whereas each individual word by itself is unclassified. So it is with science. The security incidents that I talked about, unfortunately, have seriously eroded the confidence of the American people and the government in the ability of our laboratory to keep the nation's most vital secrets. The implication is that scientists can't keep secrets, and I disagree with that totally. The government, I believe, may have overreacted to these events by tacitly accepting the implication of significant foreign espionage, convening congressional committee hearings, and passing legislation intended to fix the problem. President Clinton's science advisor, Dr. Neil Lane, was quoted in the Washington Post last week as saying, and I quote, "The American people have been subjected to sensational allegations of Chinese espionage and lax security by the press over the past year or two, and to a congressional response that in many ways can only be described as ready, fire, aim." The President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board wrote a report in 1999 on security at the National Laboratories that was entitled "Science at Its Best, Security at Its Worst." That was a devastating report for all of the national laboratories because the implication was that you couldn't have science and security in balance, and that we certainly didn't have them in balance at the time of their report. This report was the driving force for Congress to create a new agency within the Department of Energy called the National Nuclear Security Administration. That new agency or administration is now functioning under the leadership of former General John Gordon, a distinguished four-star general with a broad background in nuclear matters, arms control, and intelligence. I think the formation of the NNSA offers hope for us to emerge from the bureaucratic morass that I think we found ourselves in the aftermath of the security incidents. We now need to refocus our energies on our vital national security mission. However, I'm still concerned that the current negative climate and low morale are not conducive to doing the good science that we need to do, and it must end. It's not enough to guard diligently the secrets that we have today. These secrets were not handed down to us on stone tablets. We created them. We must ensure that we have a strong, vital scientific culture so that we can continue to make scientific and technological advances needed to meet our national security mission. We are the ones who create the secrets that are worth this country protecting. A recent report, President Clinton, by former Senator Howard Baker and former Congressman Lee Hamilton, entitled Science and Security in the Service of Our Nation, was just released. It cautions that a decline in national laboratory scientific vitality is a likely result in the present security atmosphere. They propose a path forward that addresses policy and management changes, including more investment in advanced security technology and a more cooperative, less threatening relationship with the technical staff. We welcome the light thrown on this longstanding problem by these and other thoughtful reports. We have come to similar conclusions ourselves, namely that the threats to national security are different today than they were during the Cold War. Cybersecurity was not a real issue 15 years ago. Terrorism, although it existed, was not a major issue that it potentially can be in the coming years. And lastly, the growth of technology is occurring worldwide. The United States no longer has the market on high technology, and that means we have to be at the cutting edge if we are to maintain our status. Our approach to solving this problem is to engage our scientific staff as partners in protecting the secret information that they create. Their engagement will produce willing cooperation as well as modern technical solutions to evolving security challenges posed by the information age. Many people in the government are starting to recognize perhaps that they created a problem that now is out of control and they need to find solutions to it. If we don't solve this problem, I think we'll do more damage to national security than the incidents that have been referred to. But I do see the pendulum swinging back, and I think it's very important. Things are starting to look up for our laboratory. We have a slow but steady recovery from the fire. The budgets are increasing again this year in Congress. However, I'm concerned about the people. Our attrition rate is up. We are having more rejections of offers of employment from people, significantly more rejections. However, quality people are still coming. I just looked at the data today, and our Asian American community actually has grown in the last year. After a period when we thought we were going to lose people, we actually had a net growth. I would like to reject the notion that science and security are incompatible. The tension that exists between the characteristics of science and security can be managed effectively. We recognize that relief from external pressure on security will not come from promises that I make, but from results that our people have. And my challenge is to engage our employees in developing a new and more effective security culture while continuing to meet our programmatic obligations and nurturing the scientific initiatives that form the foundation for future contributions to our nation's security. Now, I have limited time. I was going to go into one or two examples of the research that you probably don't know goes on at Los Alamos, so I'm only going to pick two examples, one from a defense programs and one from a non-defense program. As you know, certifying the safety and reliability of the nation's nuclear stockpile without nuclear testing is as great a technical challenge as I think our laboratory has ever faced. It requires advanced computer simulations. It requires new experimental capabilities. And we need to have creativity and innovation just as we had during the Manhattan Project. One new idea that Los Alamos is developing in collaboration with Livermore is something called proton radiography. Everybody's heard about X-radiography, where you X-ray the image of something and you get a photograph. Well, it's a pinhole picture, just like the old pinhole cameras that you had. If you have to penetrate a very thick object like you have in a nuclear weapon, it becomes very challenging for the X-rays to get through and to form an image with sufficient resolution. We've learned to do that over the last 40 years. Nonetheless, it's still very, very challenging. The advantage of protons are that they're very penetrating, but they also carry electrical charge, which means they can be refocused by a lens, in this case, a magnetic lens. So it's the difference between having a pinhole camera image and having almost like a multi-lens photographic image with high-quality resolution. That's very exciting. It's also something that we think offers tremendous capability for other things outside of defense. This year, we took the first ever motion picture of the dynamics of an experimental implosion, a time series of 11 radiographic images in 1/10,000th of a second. It was the most complex radiograph that's ever been taken at our laboratory. The last thing I'm going to talk about, which you, I think many of you are aware of because we're here in Walnut Creek. In April of 2000, the Secretary of Energy announced that researchers at the Joint Genome Institute located here in Walnut Creek had decoded in draft form the genetic information on human chromosomes 5, 16, and 19. Knowledge, of course, of the effects of DNA structure variations amongst individuals may help researchers to diagnose and treat and possibly even eradicate more than 4,000 genetically inherited disorders. The Joint Genome Institute, which was established in 1997, is one of the largest publicly funded human genome sequencing centers in the world. The three national laboratories managed for the Department of Energy by the University of California, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and Los Alamos, operate the Joint Genome Institute as a consortium. What is less well known, however, is that at the beginning of the Human Genome Project, it was Los Alamos and Livermore that pushed for the creation of the Human Genome Project against a community at that time of scientists who thought it was a crazy idea and had little chance of success. However, just about 15 years after that point, we will complete the final sequence of the entire human genome, which I think will revolutionize health in the 21st century. Let me just conclude by saying those are just two examples of the types of synergistic research that I think pays back to this country because we have the quality of people we have. If I cannot hire and retain outstanding people, I will not be able to carry out my national security mission for the country, and I don't think the benefits that will affect all of society will be possible. Let me just conclude by saying that our employees are loyal, talented, and dedicated people. A lot of them have been feeling very bad about the reflections on them personally, that they are not loyal, that they can't protect secrets. They are loyal, they are talented, and they are dedicated people. They do contribute to our scientific endeavors that are important to the nation and indeed to the world. Working together, I believe we're going to put these difficult days behind us as a laboratory and show that we're able to manage this balance between science and security successfully. If we're going to live in a free nation like we have, I think maintaining that balance between science and security is not only important to Los Alamos, it's important to you, and in fact, it's important to the entire nation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. John Brown, Director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, for your remarks here this evening. And now, Andrea Weidner, correspondent for the Contra Costa Times, will conduct tonight's question and answer session. Andrea?
Okay, let's start out with a question about the Wenho Lee case. First, the question is it fair? Do you understand why people feel that there was discrimination in the Wenho Lee case? And
Yeah, why don't you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you feel it's fair to say that the government and Los Alamos jumped the gun in arresting and firing Wen-Ho Lee? And do you understand that the allegations of racial discrimination?
Yeah, I think I probably understand more than most people because I was so close to the issues that occurred there. First of all, let me say that Los Alamos National Lab did fire Dr. Lee, but the reasons we fired him had nothing to do with allegations of espionage. They had nothing to do with the FBI's evidence, and I'll use those words carefully. They had to do with our security investigations of Dr. Lee over a period of about a year. And the information that was leaked to the press regarding Dr. Lee did not come from Los Alamos. We were very careful in dealing with that situation, and frankly, I was very disappointed to see how the media handled that whole reaction to his firing. With respect to racial profiling, I can tell you within our laboratory, we were very careful to look at this issue. And I said this publicly many times, if there was racial profiling done, it was not done at Los Alamos. It was done elsewhere in the federal government, and I believe that very strongly.
There are a lot of questions about the media's role in this, and I was hoping you could answer the question about were you prepared for the media frenzy surrounding the Wen-Ho Lee case, and what was the biggest surprise for you?
No, I was not prepared. That's certainly true. I think the biggest impact that I saw from the media was the release of information that many of us thought was classified information. And I know a lot of employees called me and said, what's going on? How could information be released from Washington that you're asking us to protect? The second thing which I thought was truly unfortunate was the attempt by the media to really make this into a full-blown espionage case without what I thought were necessary details that would lead you to that conclusion. I read the Cox Commission report, and it had very inflammatory statements at the beginning of the report about espionage on a particular weapon system at Los Alamos. And I read the rest of the report, which is a very long report. And I must say that I found it very difficult to make the direct link between the details in the thick report and the inflammatory statements. The press picked up on those inflammatory statements, and I think they made a strong case in the media for espionage when I think, from my opinion, it has yet to been proven from a much more detailed technical point of view.
Following up on that, do you have any particular comment on the coverage by the New York Times?
That's a difficult question. I guess I expected better of the New York Times.
In your opinion, was the political response to the two incidents at Los Alamos appropriate, and what should have been the Department of Energy and congressional response?
Well, I think Congress reacted probably the only way it knew how to react, in the sense that most of the people in Congress that I dealt with were very sincere in trying to get to the bottom of the issue, including Representative Cox from here in California. I thought he was a very sincere person who really wanted to understand what the problems were and to get to the bottom of the issues. However, I think there were some people in Congress who saw this as an opportunity to make it into a political issue, and then I think things got out of hand. It put a lot of pressure on the Department of Energy to do something to solve this problem at Los Alamos. I mean, I remember the words in the hearings were very strong. What heads are going to roll? Is there going to be blood in the aisles at Los Alamos? We need to fix the problem at Los Alamos. Now, I admit that everything in security was not perfect at Los Alamos. It shouldn't have been possible to have a download of classified material into an unclassified computer. We fixed that, but is that what you should do then is destroy the whole laboratory as a result of having weaknesses in your security system? Since that time, Los Alamos has had over 50 audits of our security system. 50 audits. We now have looked through every nook and cranny of our security system, and the Department of Energy has given us a satisfactory rating, which is their highest rating across the board in every aspect of security. Now, does that mean everything's going to always be perfect? The world is not perfect, but we have to be diligent and try to do the best we can. But in the process, I don't think you destroy the institution to, quote, fix the problem.
We have two questions about whether the lab was becoming a fall guy, has become a fall guy for security incidents throughout the national government, and whether the Secretary of Energy was unfairly scapegoated for security problems that happened in recent days rather than...
Let me answer the last part first. You know, Secretary Richardson has taken a lot of criticism for his actions. But I must tell you, in the vast majority of the dealings I have with Secretary Richardson, he was trying to do the right thing. He did sit down and talk to me many times, called me at home personally to talk over issues. It was not an overreaction in the sense that I think he wanted to harm any of the national laboratories, but he felt a lot of pressure personally to do something as the head of the Department of Energy to solve these problems. And there were problems that needed to be fixed, and he fixed, you know, the vast majority of those. Whether Los Alamos has been a scapegoat, you know, that's a hard question to answer, because when you're down, it's hard to get up when everybody's trying to knock you down again. That's sort of the feeling that most of us had at the laboratory, was that we were being criticized for many what I would consider less significant events during a period when it was heightened sensitivity. And if you had done the same thing 2 years ago, there wouldn't have been a murmur in the press about that type of action. So I do feel that we were under a microscope. I think we're still under a microscope at our laboratory, and we feel that way.
Okay. The next question is, do you feel national security of the United States is in better shape today than it was 2 years ago?
Well, I think the nuclear weapons program, the stockpile stewardship program, is in better shape than it was 2 or 3 years ago. There are still a lot of issues. I think we have fixed some of the holes in security that were there at the end of the Cold War. I don't think anybody was prepared for the cybersecurity, information security vulnerabilities that exist. And by the way, they don't only exist at the DOE laboratories. They exist across the federal government. You just haven't heard about them in many other parts of the federal government. So I think we are more secure than we were 2 years ago. And I think we have a better handle on how to accomplish our mission as well. So I would say that we do have a better handle on national security than at that time. I will tell you I'll sleep a lot better at night if Dr. Lee tells us what he did with those tapes.
Okay. Do you think that the spread of the knowledge needed to make nuclear weapons is simply inevitable? And is this the biggest challenge, to keep the information from terrorists or unfriendly states?
Well, the secret to how to make a nuclear weapon has been out for a long time, so I think that's not what's at stake here. To create a nuclear weapon state requires more than the nuclear design information. You have to have the ability to know how to handle nuclear materials. You have to get large quantities of nuclear materials. You have to know how to manufacture and build real weapon systems as opposed to devices that might explode but couldn't necessarily be carried to their site. Now, that's not necessarily true for terrorists, where they don't particularly care about putting it on top of a missile. I think the bigger issue is is, can we buy time for the world to solve its problems so that we don't need so many nuclear weapons in the world? I think that's the biggest challenge for the future in this 21st century is, what is the role of nuclear deterrence going to be? It needs reexamining after the end of the Cold War. I think all of us would like to have other nations not develop large numbers of nuclear weapons. We're not going to uninvent the nuclear weapon. We all understand that. But we'd like to get to a situation where there was not large-scale developments of nuclear weapons, particularly in developing countries like India and Pakistan and Iran and Iraq, etc.
Next, we have a question about spying. The origin of the recent Chinese spy event is described in the century-old Chinese book, The Art of War. That strategy was apparently successful. Can you comment?
Well, I think, as I said, Dr. Li was not charged with espionage. And whether there is significant enough information to say whether the U.S. lost nuclear weapons design information, I would say the jury is out on that issue. And the fact that the federal government did not charge Dr. Li with espionage, I think, is a very important issue. Doesn't mean it didn't occur. Doesn't mean someone else couldn't have given information away to other countries. But the fact is that from my perspective, I don't think we know the answer to that.
This question goes to stockpile stewardship. Does the laboratory's program of subcritical testing discourage other countries from fully committing to the nuclear test ban treaty? And are these tests allowing the United States to develop a new weapons for its stockpile?
Let me answer the second part of that. Subcritical testing, which occurs in the Nevada test site, does not yield nuclear energy in bringing parts together with explosions. It does help us certify the safety and reliability of the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile. It would not allow us to develop a new nuclear weapons design. What was the first part, Andrea? I'm sorry.
It was talking about the nuclear test ban treaty.
We've had discussions with the Russians in particular on this issue. The Russians conduct subcritical testing at their test site because they also believe it's important for them to certify the safety and reliability of their nuclear weapons. They don't believe they can develop a nuclear weapon with subcritical testing either. So does the subcritical testing drive other countries to develop nuclear weapons? Well, I can't speak for what's in their minds. All one can say is, since you are not creating a nuclear explosion in a subcritical assembly, you're not generating large quantities of nuclear energy through these tests, one could argue that they could be conducted in any country without anybody even knowing they occurred. You could do these in India, Pakistan, China, Japan, and you would not know they're going on. The fact is the U.S. announces that we do them because they're part of our stockpile stewardship program.
This question is a follow-up on that. How do you reconcile the stockpile stewardship program's objective of maintaining reliable nuclear weapons for the foreseeable future with the legal obligation to disarm under the Non-Proliferation Treaty?
Yeah, the decision to disarm has to be made by the U.S. government and by the American people. As long as we have nuclear weapons, we feel very strongly at our laboratory, and I know Livermore feels the same way, that we have an obligation to ensure to the president that the weapons that we are responsible for from the design and manufacturing perspective, that those weapons are safe and would work if they were ever required. Otherwise, they're not a real deterrent to global conflict. So the issue for us isn't so much whether or not the stockpile stewardship is in conflict with the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Non-Proliferation Treaty has an objective, which is a long-term objective. The question is, how do you get from where you are today to zero nuclear weapons? I would say it's not a clear path on how you do that. It involves more policy than it does technology. But during that period of transition, we feel we have a strong obligation to do our mission. Otherwise, the president will be in a very weakened position if he's ever required or challenged by another country.
This question goes to the University of California contract to run Los Alamos. What fundamental or key changes do you expect in the UC contract? And what areas do you think have to be changed to ensure the contract gets extended?
Well, I don't know exactly how it will turn out. There are several areas under discussion with the Department of Energy. One is requiring more oversight at the Office of the President of the University of California so that one could consider how, on a day-to-day basis, the laboratory directors deal with the university on various operational issues and also in planning the evolution of our laboratories. In addition, at our laboratories, we're looking at ways that we can utilize external expertise in security systems that would help us look at best practices in industry or other governmental labs, such as the National Security Agency or the Department of Defense or industry themselves for security systems. In the area of project management, because of some of the difficulties associated with the National Ignition Facility, there is going to be a requirement for the laboratories to engage more external expertise in both the planning and execution of large projects like the NIF. And then in the last area, which affects Los Alamos particularly and not so much Lawrence Livermore Lab, is in the operation of large nuclear facilities like our plutonium facility, where Los Alamos is recreating the ability to manufacture plutonium pits, the core of the weapon, after Rocky Flats, which did this for many years, was closed down. The country lost the ability to do that. That's a very big challenge for a scientific laboratory to learn how to manufacture pits that are so-called war reserve pits without doing a test of them. And how we operate those facilities, the Department of Energy has asked the university in Los Alamos to take a look at bringing in some external expertise from the nuclear industry to help us, particularly with some of the safety issues associated with a large nuclear facility.
The next question involves the National Ignition Facility. What do you make of the problems with Lawrence Livermore Laboratory has had with the National Ignition Facility, and what impact have those had on stockpile stewardship?
The National Ignition Facility, we all agreed, was a very important facility for stockpile stewardship in that it allowed you to create, albeit on a small scale, the types of temperatures and pressures that occur in a nuclear weapon. And so it would be important under a regime of no nuclear testing to allow us to understand the physics that went into nuclear weapons design. In addition, we all felt that it was important for Livermore to have a magnet facility, a scientific magnet facility that would allow Livermore to attract people to the laboratory from the university community. The project itself, I think many of us were concerned at the beginning of the project that the amount of contingency funding that the Department of Energy provided the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory was not adequate. And the only question is, what lessons now can we all learn from that big project so that we don't repeat those mistakes at our laboratory or any other laboratory?
This question goes more to science. Can you tell us more about the lab's research on supercomputing, and will the supercomputing power have a positive effect on the next phase of the Human Genome Project?
Good question. That's an excellent question. The large-scale computing that we are doing today is with a machine that we call Blue Mountain. It operates at 3 trillion operations per second. and it's operating in what we would call a production mode. It is doing calculations that are three-dimensional, which means that you can take an object like this gavel, which perhaps has symmetry around one axis, so that if you rotate it, it looks the same, but then you can put a dent in it, and it makes it non-symmetrical because it doesn't look the same anymore when you rotate it. We now can do three-dimensional calculations that open up a tremendous opportunity for solving not only stockpile stewardship problems, but other complex structures. Wherever you have to have a very complicated structure that allows you to put in large numbers of calculational elements, we now have the ability to do it with fine resolution that we could never do in the past. With respect to the human genome, I think that's probably the area that has the largest opportunity for computational calculations. I don't think we've really even begun to scratch the surface of how computations will affect the genome. And the reason for that is we've just learned how to sequence the genome. That's to put together basically the dictionary. Now the question is, how do those genes, how are they built? What are their structures? What do they actually look like? And then the more important question is, how do they function? What do they do? How do proteins fold and unfold with the genes? That's going to take tremendous calculational power to really unravel that mystery, and it's that mystery that I think will be the part that has the biggest implications for health.
How much do the lab's priorities change with different political parties occupying the White House?
Well, that's a good question. I think over the years, it certainly has had an impact. If you go back in history and look at the oil crisis of the 70s, all the national laboratories responded to that crisis by developing programs in oil and alternative energy sources. And when President Reagan came in, he made a very big push to strengthen our national security programs, in particular strategic defense. That changed the makeup of the programs in our laboratory dramatically. Similarly, when President Clinton came in, there was a big push at first for the laboratories to work very closely with industry because the country was having serious problems. If we seem to have all forgotten about economic competitiveness, but at the period of 1988 through 93, we were struggling as a country in many fields that we had traditionally dominated. And so there was a lot of emphasis from that political party to engage the laboratories working with industry. When the new Congress came in 1994, they essentially turned that upside down overnight and called it corporate welfare. So, yes, we are influenced dramatically by political parties.
Okay, and our last question will be, you noted that Asian American community has grown at the lab during the past year. Do you have numbers? And if so, to what do you attribute this increase?
Yeah, I'll try to remember the numbers off the top of my head. We had about 15 people leave the laboratory, and we had about 24 people join the laboratory for a net increase of about 9. Those numbers are not dramatic, but I think the reason that we didn't see it go down is that I spent a lot of time personally with our Asian American community talking to them about what their problems really were outside of the Wen-Ho Lee case, because they had other issues with our laboratory about their own employment, about their future, with their opportunities to grow both as scientists and as people. And so we have started as a laboratory to do, for example, we did a survey of our entire Asian Pacific community and asked them to help develop that survey. And then we are putting in place initiatives that are helping that community realize their full potential in our laboratory. I would say at first they were skeptical that we were serious about this, and I won't say that every individual in that community believes that everything we're doing they agree with. On the other hand, I would say the vast majority of that community are pleased that the laboratory is looking at their issues and working them on a personal level. The way it was said to me most effectively was, how are you going to fix the problems of recruiting Asian Americans to Los Alamos? And a very senior University of California official who happens also to be Asian American told me, gave me some very good advice. He said, John, fix your problems at home and the students will return. I came back to our Asian American community and I discussed it with them and they said, that's the best advice you could ever be given. And so I think that's what we're going to focus on, is make our laboratory the best laboratory we can make it for all communities, not just Asian Americans, but people of all backgrounds, so that we don't have a similar issue in the future. Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. John Brown, director of Los Alamos National Laboratory, for joining us this evening. We also thank those watching on C-SPAN or listening on the radio. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the Contra Costa Times is adjourned. Mm-hmm.